and that's just the way it goes.
It's like the definition of multitasking. You're like, here, let me do this caregiving job. Also, let me do my real job. Let's combine the two.
Well, and I think it's interesting. We really need to think about the skills that caregivers bring. Because multitasking is a great example, project management, financial management, advocating, learning new things very quickly, all sorts of things, skills that caregivers gain through just being a caregiver that the workplace is desperately in need of. So
learning never to lose your sense of humor.
Also very true.
We find humor in dark places.
We have to find humor in dark places.
You do.
Also, like, it does teach you patience. And how to keep your cool, like even giving my daughter some tips on how to play her in her finals today. Like, you have to think about the impact of your behavior in the second.
That's Krista, by the way, recording this episode from her car between caregiving duties and cheering on her daughter in a lacrosse tournament. And honestly, there's something perfect about that. In Ontario, more than 4 million people provide unpaid care to someone they love. And in this episode, we're talking about what it really means to be a caregiver. The juggle, the weight, the worry, and yes, the wins. Welcome to Coming of Age, the podcast that's changing the conversation about aging and reimagining the future of care. Most people want to age at home, and most will be able to, but we know that by the age of 80, 1 in 5 will need daily medical and personal care that can only be provided in long-term care. In this conversation, we're joined by two guests who've lived through that transition. Laura Vita became a young caregiver for her father. Now a registered nurse, she brings a powerful mix of personal and professional perspective to our conversation. Krista Hanstra is a national leader in caregiver advocacy and a caregiver to her father who lives with frontotemporal dementia. Krista is also the founder of 4C Strategy, where she helps health and community leaders center caregiver voices in care system design. Together, we'll talk about what families go through before and after long-term care and what they wish more people knew. A big thank you to our sector champion, Plan A, for generously sponsoring this episode. Let's dive in. I'm really interested in, and maybe Krista, we can start with you. And if each of you could perhaps start by walking us through your caregiving journey. So Krista, we'll start with you and then Laura, we'll let you do back up and follow up.
Thanks so much, Donna. I'm a passionate advocate for family caregivers, so I'm thrilled to be able to share my own experience about being a family member to someone who now lives in long-term care. But my family caregiving journey started many years, I would say about 10 years before my dad moved into long-term care. And it started really unexpectedly. My dad had never been sick a day in his life. I honestly can say I never saw my dad take a sick day. So when we got a call from his boss saying something's not right, that was when our journey started. And so he was still working at the time. And it was his boss who said, we think something's going on. And could you meet with us to talk about it with your dad, which we did at the time. And then ultimately got him diagnosed after a series of missteps, which is typical with the diagnosis that he has, which is frontal temporal lobe dementia. He probably had symptoms of it for probably a number of years before we even knew that something was wrong. And so ultimately he was diagnosed and then we worked with him to retire with dignity because that was really important to him. And luckily he worked somewhere where they were willing to work with us. And then ultimately his journey with that disease has gone on for 10 years. And so yeah, it's been at first it was a lot easier. He could still talk. He could still share what he wanted and we knew what he liked. But even at the point of diagnosis, it was too late to have some serious conversations. Like even, would you want to be in a home? We had missed that window of opportunity. We haven't missed it, believe me, with other people in our families because now we understand how important that is. So we could still understand what he needed and he could communicate that. But over the number of years that we've been caring for him, he has lost his ability to communicate verbally or to understand information. So we've had to really adapt how we work with him and how we support him. And it's really hard. I mean, it's a very long goodbye. That's what they talk about with dementia. I would say it's this idea of ambiguous grief. Like I've lost my dad, but he's still physically here. And you have to kind of mourn the loss of this man who you knew and learn to love this new man who's in front of you. And he's so much different of a person. He's not a father figure in your typical way. And yet I still learn things from him in this change that we see, because you have to learn to love him in a different way. So my journey's been going on for 10 years. I'm not the primary caregiver. My mom is. I have siblings who are part of this picture as well. But it has meant moving him out of the home they lived in for 45 years to be closer to the rest of the family. And then ultimately, after the caregiving expectations of my mom, and even with a full-time paid caregiver, just became too much. We needed to look at long-term care for my dad, and he has been there for about 8 months now.
That's such a powerful way of framing it, ambiguous grief. Well said. Laura, your transition has been similar yet different.
Krista and I, when we first met, had so many parallels between our two stories. It was kind of shocking. She's one of the only other people that I know who had an experience that was so similar to mine. So my caregiving journey was approximately 10 years as well, and changed throughout the duration of those 10 years. My dad similarly was diagnosed with atypical early onset Alzheimer's, and he was diagnosed in 2013 and passed in October of 2023. So it was a 10-year journey for us as well. We had a similar situation, only ours was a family that was a little bit younger with younger kids. So my dad started showing symptoms, they think sort of maybe in his mid-50s. And it was a series of missteps or misdiagnoses and things that they thought, oh, this is what it is, and let's tackle this together. And things seemed to work for a little while, but nothing seemed to really work permanently until we got the care that we needed to get and we had the tests run that we needed to have run. So he was officially diagnosed when he was in his very early 60s at 62. And at that time, I was diagnosed when he was 19, and my older brother was also in university, and my younger brother was still living at home. He was 16 or 17 at the time. So we were a bit younger for that experience and when that started. And so our early days of caregiving were definitely focused on my mom, and then focused on us just spending quality time as kids with their dad. So that looked a little bit different. And then as we grew up and as my dad changed, it got to a point where my mom and I decided that I would move back to London into our family home, and then would take a job also in the city so that I could be close and I would move back in with them to sort of get myself on my feet a little bit and to make sure that he had the care that he needed at home. And we were able to manage him at home until he ultimately ended up going into long-term care. And that was a choice that he and my mom did make together. So originally, when he was initially diagnosed, there were discussions about whether we would do a renovation to the house and would we do caregiving at home permanently and sort of what that looked like. My dad was actually able to verbalize his desire to have our home be our home, and for him to be able to be cared for outside of our home if that's what we needed at the time. So he was involved in those conversations in the beginning and sort of gave us his blessing of whatever is best for our family unit. And he wasn't the person to be able to make that call. We were given the blessing to make that call, and long-term care was certainly a part of that discussion. And so he moved into long-term care in February of 2020, just in that pre-pandemic, just on the cusp there, and then lived the remainder of his days there in long-term care.
Both of you have touched on, and it comes back to your ambiguous grief statement, Krista, and my journey was a 10-year journey as well with my father with Alzheimer's and supporting him at home and then transitioning him into a long-term care home for the end of his life. One of the things I certainly heard a lot about and felt myself was going through those stages of grief almost twice. As you were going through your journeys, what made the biggest difference for you and your mom's and for your dad's?
Yeah, I mean, when I think about it, I do a lot of work with family caregivers. I think I'm very lucky. I know we work hard at it, but I do feel like we're blessed to have a family who has a similar perspective on most of the steps that we've taken. And so to me, that has eliminated having to like negotiate what the next step should be with family members. And that would have been really hard. With we take an approach with my mom. We've come to, I mean, she kind of jokes about it too now, but we know when it's time to make the next big decision that we kind of have to plant some seeds with her and then let her have a bit of time and then come back and ultimately like make a recommendation. And the way that I work, I like to look at all the options and explore them and look at the pros and cons. And when we do that with my mom, it's very overwhelming for her. So we don't do that anymore, but we had to learn that. And then we are like, okay, we think you should do this. And here's the reasons why. These are the other options that we can talk about, but this is where we think we should go. And we always say, you can say no today, but we're going to come and talk about it in a few days. So we've kind of figured out how to work with my mom on the decisions. And I think the other big thing is, and I remember it was a physician actually who said this to me, is because my dad can't express his needs anymore, to make the decisions on his behalf, first of all, of course, from a place of love, but secondly, with your best possible understanding of what he would have wanted. And honestly, that's a bit hard because my dad's personality pre-diagnosis was distinctly different than his personality after. And so it's you have to think, okay, with what version of my dad do we make this decision? But we do everything thoughtfully. And of course, there's a lot of emotion in that. And it's very difficult sometimes. But honestly, one of the biggest things has been being able to have a family that is open to the discussions and that ultimately we're mostly on the same page. Because I've heard lots of people talk about how family members see things differently. So thank goodness that's not the situation I'm in.
That's super helpful. And Laura, what helped you? What really made the difference for you? And you took yourself out of the workforce and changed your career entirely to ensure that you're able to support your mother and father.
Very similar to Krista, it was really a lot of our decisions were made very much as a unit. Now, my mom was obviously the leader of that unit as the like absolute go-to person to be making decisions. But we also had a lot of family support. My siblings very much involved. I was very much involved, my extended family, my uncle, my dad's brother, like we had a lot of support that way. I think the other thing was that we were my parents were in a position to be able to have me move home and only work part-time. So that's also a bit of an interesting position that they were able to provide me with a roof over my head while I was helping them. There was a really symbiotic relationship there while I was only working part-time outside of the home in order to give caregiving. I think the other thing that I would say in our particular situation is that we had a lot of community support as well. So my dad had a very good group of friends that he made in elementary and high school from their little neighborhood, who once information got out and they found out that my dad had this diagnosis, those group of friends, that group of guys rolled up in the minivan and would take my dad out every single week for lunch and an adventure. Just some really good quality friendships of people who helped him feel that he was still a person who very much mattered to them and that relationship mattered. So we had a lot of good community and friendship support outside of that. And a lot of people who would organize with my mom and I, okay, when can I come and take Mike for coffee? When could I come for a tea and have a visit with Mike? We had a lot of people in our life because my dad was such a relationship builder that he invested in those relationships when he was someone who was well and able and really loved to love people. And they poured that back into him in times where some people might face social isolation or they might be taking themselves out of social settings. My dad was very much so welcomed and encouraged, and people loved to come in and see him. So the community, family, friend, like all of those dynamics worked really to help. Like certainly my mom and I, but definitely my dad, maintain a real sense of independence and a sense of a person who has importance, which he had great importance to many people.
Wow, that whole sense of purpose and relationship, right?
We didn't have the same experience, I would say. My dad was quite isolated right from the get-go. Not that he didn't have connections. A lot of his connections were through work. But it was hard because he didn't communicate a lot. And so we kind of actually took it a bit of a creative approach to giving my mom some respite by starting to hire people or have friends, and we did have friends or family, take my dad for a drive every day. So that was my mom's break, was when he would go out of the house. And originally when we did that, it was like a 2 to 3 hour drive. So I would do it once a week. My sister would do it once a week. My mom would do it pretty regularly. And then we had a driver that we hired. And then we had some friends and family who would do it. But he like literally for 5 years went for a drive every single day, every single day. So that's a huge responsibility for my mom. And she got bored of it and also needed a break. So that was one way we kind of creatively found respite for my mom. Now that got shorter and shorter as he got. So an hour out of the house for my mom wasn't really respite. So one of the other big things we did was hire private support. We definitely got support through the system, home care through the system, and day programs. Although when COVID hit, those fell off and then my dad wasn't eligible anymore. So private care was also very helpful.
Both of you are really sophisticated navigators. So Laura, you're as a nurse, Krista, you've worked in the healthcare system. You're really sophisticated, and yet you felt gaps. Were there gaps that just didn't get filled?
I know, Krista, I think your family faced a similar situation with, we also went the route of hiring private caregivers because we weren't able to get the amount of care that we needed from the home care system at the time. And so I think that's where it was a struggle because we didn't fit neatly into a box of what someone might need. And so it took a lot of creativity on our behalf to come up with a system that worked for us. So I do feel like because we were a very unusual case study, it was hard to get the things that we needed because we don't quite tick the boxes. Like, well, your dad still communicates pretty well. So that's, he doesn't really qualify in this way, but occasionally he can still bathe himself. There were just like, as things changed, we really had a hard time fitting in that box. And so then it became really difficult to like, to have the care we needed when we needed it, because it was like, okay, well, you would qualify for however many hours in a week. And even that we could qualify for that, and that was great. But then the additional, like the backside of that was that, number one, it wasn't enough to really cover us. And number two, we had many a situation where somebody was supposed to come and they weren't able to show, they had been double booked. We had a lot of that went on where our community came around us a lot. Other family members came around us a lot. And when we qualified for home care and got it, it was great. But there were a number of instances where it didn't feel like we quite fit, or when we did fit, then the service wasn't available at the time.
Well, and it's so telling because we know that the baby boomers who are in aging are going to be much older. They're going to have more medical complexity. And so which chronic disease are we going to manage? And who's going to help managing it? So even thinking more future forward, you're going to have dementia plus. And everyone talks about aging in place and aging in their family home. We hear it a lot from politicians. We don't need to build more long-term care beds because we're supporting aging in place. Maybe each of you could speak about what it was like for you when you did everything you could to keep your dad aging in the family home. And then that moment when you can't, no matter how much you kind of know it's coming, it can happen really quickly. And I know from so many phone calls I get from individuals saying, I don't even have my mom on a wait list. And suddenly she's in a crisis situation and we need to find a long-term care space because she was going to age at home. What was that experience like, Krista, for you?
Well, yeah. So I'll just talk about gaps really quickly, because to me, one of the biggest gaps is respite, and respite very broadly defined. So again, I mentioned my dad ultimately wasn't eligible for day programs. Overnight respite or long stay respite was almost impossible. So that means that if we wanted, my mom wanted to go away, one of us had to stay with my dad, or we had to find someone else to stay with him. So just kind of highlighting, I think that's really key. I would say we hit a mini crisis before we hit our major crisis. So it was a bit of a dry run on when it was time for my dad to go into long-term care. And it will be no surprise that kind of two major things were factors. Three major things. Caregiver burnout, for sure, was definitely, like, we're 10 years in my dad went into long-term care in 2024, but my mom had lived through however many years you want to consider COVID to have been, a lot of it on her own 24/7. The second thing was behaviors. Thank goodness my dad has an atypical presentation of frontal temporal lobe dementia, because when we Googled it at the beginning, I was like, oh my goodness, we are in for a ride. But that has not been how my dad is presented, but he still has behaviors that are need to be managed. So that was another thing. And ultimately, they became kind of hard to manage at home. And then third, the incontinence, which becomes usually a factor that leads to long-term care as well. Like, that was really hard on my mom. Every single morning, it was a very big deal. She needed to have a caregiver or one of me, or was mostly my brother actually, who helped her in the mornings. But it was stripping the bed, showering him, putting the things back on the bed, doing the laundry, like every single day, 7 days a week. And then it might happen during the day again. So that became really challenging. And then my mom had a health crisis, and one of my siblings had a health crisis. And so that was when we were like, okay, wait a second. If this happens, what are we going to do with my dad? Well, we had a full-time private caregiver who was able to help us, as well as all of the rest of the kids stepping in to help. But that's when we had the discussion to say, we think we're hitting a crisis point with Ontario Health at Home. And that's when we discovered, again, like Laura said, my dad didn't tick the boxes. On some point, someone said he doesn't have memory issues. He doesn't speak. How can you assess memory issues? That doesn't make sense. But you know what he did have? He still to this day, what he has is procedural memory. So he needs to follow the exact same routine every day, and then he's okay. But that's not memory. That's procedural memory, which made it hard for us, because when he left the home, he was not in a, like, if he came to my house, we realized he couldn't come anymore. He would like tap on the walls trying to find the door. And so that became really hard. My mom couldn't even bring him anywhere. He could only really be at home to be comfortable. And he had to have dinner at the exact same time. He woke up at the same time. He had to go for his drive at 10 o'clock in the morning. But that was his procedural memory, not a regular memory. So when the time came, it was one of those things where I think we put off the decision as long as we could. And what we kind of identified as the tipping point was a discussion with my mom where we said, okay, mom, for 10 years, we have been making every decision in dad's best interest. We have to flip the switch now and make the decisions in your best interest, because you're burnt out and it's going to start to impact your health. And that was the switch for us. But also hard, right? Because we're saying to my mom, we're making the decision, but it's heart-wrenching, because even though I work in the system, long-term care still was an unknown to me. And we were very worried about his ability to adjust to a different setting because he had such strong procedural memory. That was the biggest thing that was so hard for us. And so, yeah, we finally pushed that button and then had someone come in and understand the degree of crisis that we were in, which again was caregiver burnout for sure, the behaviors, which were becoming really hard for my mom to tolerate, and the incontinence, and literally him not being able to leave the house because of his procedural memories.
I would say that we ended up in a relatively similar spot. Definitely caregiver burnout, definitely behavior. My dad's vision was very much impacted, especially at first. And so he really lost recognition of places that were familiar to him. So he would get very anxious because he would like to go home. And he would say that a lot. I want to go home. It's like, all right, we're sitting in the kitchen at home. I'm not sure where we are going because we are at home. So like there was a lot of anxiety. And so it became those behaviors where it was like very hard to help him settle because he couldn't recognize where he was. And so that was one of the things. And then when he got agitated or anxious, he would need to get up and leave. So then he'd be going and trying to leave and trying to wander. So we had a little bit more of the wandering in terms of behavior because he thought, oh my gosh, I'm anxious. I need to figure out where home is, and that's where I need to go to because that's where I can be calm. So it was that sort of on a loop that got to be really difficult to manage. And then it was the same, very similar caregiver burnout for sure for both my mom and myself. We were also at a really interesting point where we were also sort of trying to make the shift to some very similar to you, Krista, that it was We need to make the decisions that are the best for my dad. And he verbalized to us that he wanted the decisions to be made for the in the best interest of the family. And he was like an extremely emotionally intelligent person and very communicative. My mom often really made this joke that he was the woman and she was the man. If you're looking at like really traditional gender roles in a relationship, which is kind of funny. That's how she would describe it. But he was able to say he wanted us as kids to go on and live our lives. And so that was something that my mom wanted too. And so we were getting to a point where I was engaged and my husband and I wanted to look for a home of our own and continue on with, quote unquote, continue on with my life, but to keep living and keep doing things because that is what he wanted. And so it was a balance of finally coming to terms with, yes, I can't stay here forever and we can't do this forever. Both my mom and I got to a point where we just really couldn't do it anymore. And the exhaustion was very real and the emotional exhaustion was really real. And so we had been on the long-term care list for about 5 years at that point. And my mom made some decisions about switching up some of the criteria, and that helped us move up the list a little bit faster. And then when we got the call, she on her own was the one who made that decision. She consulted some people who she really wanted to just confirm that was the right choice. But I came, like, she took that sort of off of my plate, and I came home from work one night, or I had worked a night shift and I was coming home in the morning, and she said, I just got the call and we're going to take the bed. I want you to know it's okay. And we walked through that together. But that was, yeah, it's a really emotionally charged moment because it's a fear of the unknown and you don't know what's going to happen when you get there. And is this going to be a good choice? And it was, and we could not have continued on, but we didn't know that at the time. And so there was a lot of fear there too with that decision.
That was the week, I would say, since my dad's diagnosis that I cried the most, was the week between getting the call that we had a space in long-term care and moving him in, because we didn't know what to expect. And because my dad was so procedurally oriented, we just were so worried about his ability to adjust. And we were worried that he was going to deteriorate quickly. And none of that happened. But I can tell you, when I got the call, all the blood drained out of my body. I had to drop everything, which is also incredibly hard, especially as someone who's self-employed. And then I had to call my sister, and we agreed that we were both going to go to my mom's house at the same time to tell her. And my mom, when we walked in, my mom knew. She's like, why are you both here in the middle of a workday? Like, she's like, something's up, clearly. And so there was a lot of tears. That was the hardest week of my life in the diagnosis with my dad, was the anticipation. So the call about long-term care and then moving in. Now, again, like, we can talk about the transition. It was way smoother than we thought, but not knowing, it was very hard because you feel like you're doing this to him, which was so hard.
Well, it's part of that grieving process too, right? Where you're cycling through that range of emotions, even though you know that what the decision and choice needs to be, it's still not an easy one to make.
To your point, Donna, it's very much, it's a grief of like, I did this thing and I thought I was going to be able to do this to the end and I couldn't do it. Like, in some very strange way in my mind, it was this grief of like, I couldn't see this through, which it was this was not a personal failing on my part. It was not a failing on any of my family members. Like, that should not have been my response, but I took it as that it was like, oh my God, there's this new change, and a grief around not being able to do it right to the very end. It was very strange for me, for sure.
Krista and I worked together in the mental health sector, and for 20 years, we were ahead of the curve talking about how it's okay not to be okay. And again, finding acceptance about what your capacity, such an important moment, but yet we put so much on our shoulders. And I'm really interested, because I know, Krista, you said, like, each of you has talked about your transitions into long-term care. And We know that people don't think, they don't want to talk about long-term care. They don't want to see long-term care. It's the stigma. There's almost as much stigma around long-term care as there was about mental illness. And yet you can manage until you can't. And then that moment comes. And yet we know that people whose loved ones then transition in, they get good care and they get good experience. So what was that transition like for you, Krista?
Well, I would say, so again, for us, it was very emotional. But what happens when that call comes is it, all of a sudden you have a new team that's supporting you to get into long-term care. And in our case, we had Behavior Supports Ontario. We had a caseworker help us while my dad's behaviors were changing at home. But when we got the call for long-term care, we got a new person whose specific focus was supporting the transition to long-term care. And she was absolutely phenomenal. She was almost like our navigator for that week of time. And she was the go-between between us and all of the different providers, including long-term care. And she was incredible. I don't think our experience would have been the same without her. He was originally given a space on a memory care unit. And when we went to see it, it was not a nice looking place. We had the utmost confidence in the care, but physically, the physical plant piece was because of it was a dementia unit. It wasn't lovely. And what ultimately ended up happening, because one of my dad has certain things that he does that, again, he has this procedural memory, but one of the things he could do was play solitaire on the computer. But he, if you gave him a different laptop, he would not be able to figure it out. He would only be able to figure it out if it was on the laptop that he had. And they said, well, the sense of personal space is different here. That laptop might not. And we were like, if that laptop breaks, we're done. Like, that's one of the three activities he does. She ultimately advocated to have him admitted to a different, move into a different unit before he even moved in. And it was so much better. As soon as we walked on it, we're like, yes, this feels more like a home. This is the unit we want him to be on. And so that transition was incredible. The team was amazing. They learned our names immediately. They knew that he had four children. They knew who my mom was. They knew who his private caregiver was. And they, to this day, they know who we are, obviously, and they talk to us and they're very personable. I can't say it enough. They really understand the relationship. And the thing that was really fascinating for us was, again, very hard for us to move him there. It was very emotional. But this is someone who had lost his ability to speak. He suddenly spoke in full sentences when he moved into long-term care for a period of time, to the point where my nephew had never heard him speak enough to know that he had an accent because he's an immigrant. So it was this like incredible moment where we thought we were providing him with all the care he could need. And somehow he found his voice it's gone now. It's been 7 months, but you know, for a couple of months, he could actually say things in sentences, and it was fascinating to us. And he's very content. That's the way I would describe him. He was content at home, but he's also content in long-term care. And I walk down the hall with him and people say hi to him because they know him, and not just the staff, but the other people who live there. And we've met families and we've been connected and people accept him for who he is and how he is, even though this isn't the dad that, again, I grew up with. So it's been a very good transition. Of course, he's declining because that is the nature of the disease, but he's content and we know he's cared for and we see it. We do have a full-time caregiver who's still with him every day, but we know that he's well cared for when she's not around as well.
That sense of community and compassion really resonates. Laura, how was your father's transition? And you did have the pandemic that you were navigating as well.
What we didn't know at the time was going to be a bit of an odd stretch in the long-term care world. So he moved in February 14th of 2020. So we rolled in on Valentine's Day and they had the whole unit was decorated. My dad did go into a memory care unit. And I think one of the things that about the transition that was so particularly helpful to us, my mom, and I think probably helpful in essence to my dad as well, because we were so much more calm. We had spent the whole entire day setting up his room. We hung pictures. It had just been freshly painted. We made it look as close to home as possible with different knickknacks and things on the walls and bedspreads and our couch and our TV and exactly the way that it would have been set up if it was just an extended room in our house. And so it looked very familiar. Like when I walked in, it was like, wow, we did a really good job. Like this really just looks like it could be another room attached to our home. And we had a very similar experience that we had people all day when we were setting up, stopping by, saying hello, introducing themselves. If I heard it once, I heard it 1,000 times. This is an extension of your home. This is a part of your home. You want to kick your shoes off here? You go right ahead. You want the dog to jump on the bed because your dad loves the dog? You go right ahead. Like we just couldn't have been more accepted. And that was really excellent. And the additional piece that was really great for us is that my dad was at day program that day. And we were able to pick him up from day program. And instead of walking out to the car, we walked down the hallway, we walked through the lobby, and we walked into his room. And we were welcome to stay as long as we want. We stayed, we had supper, like we had people still stopping by. Oh my gosh, Mike, I've heard that you're just new here. I'm just coming to introduce myself. Like really that the day went off so well that my mom and I kind of looked at each other and was like, okay, we're going to be okay. He's going to be okay. And it was real, like it was a moment that I didn't realize that I needed of knowing, okay, there are people who care about him here. And you don't know that until you get there and someone extends a hand to you and says, this is who I am. And I'm going to be working with your dad. And they had us fill out an about Mike. And so we got like that got passed around to staff and it was hung on his door. And these are the things that he likes. And he was a teacher and he's a drummer and different things about him. And so people would know him to speak to him and engage with him. And so the transition of the actual day that I was terrified of, I mean, I went to my car and my mom and I sat and cried when we left, like full disclosure, it was still hard, but it made it easier knowing like, okay, there are people here who care. And it really made that day a lot easier. And then we did get into navigating shortly after that, COVID and lockdowns. And that was a rough transition on its own from this is an extension of your home. You're welcome here at all hours of the day and night. You come and go as you please to time out. We got to be careful. We can't have people coming in. So that was a shock to the system. But because we knew that they cared and they had made that very clear to us at the beginning, it was easier to accept like he's getting good care there, even though we can't be the ones to go in and provide it. So it was a very tough transition. I don't think COVID was easy on anyone, but I think in the back of my mind, knowing, no, I know people there and I know their names and they know my name and they know his name and they actually care about him, that there was something in that for me that made it easier for sure.
And certainly the COVID experience was Ontario long-term care homes were hard hit. It was a global shape-shifting virus that preyed on older people. And our pandemic, I always chuckle when people talk about 2020 as the pandemic. In long-term care homes in Ontario, it lasted 3 years. And so a lot of those measures were still in place even 3 years after as the virus continued to morph and shape-shift. One thing I wanted to ask you, because both of you have had now post-COVID long-term care experience, there's a lot of mythology out there, I think, about what and why things happened in long-term care homes. We know that the setup and design of the homes was not optimal with where we had more than two people in a room, some of the staffing, HVAC systems. Thankfully, in Ontario, the government of Ontario has made historic investments in and is really committed to rebuilding the system and rebuilding the sector and rebuilding the homes and building them in the context of local communities as well, which is really important. Our sense is that there's been still an overcorrection. So each of you has talked about the home-like environment. We talk about long-term care homes. We have cabinet ministers in the government of Ontario, Canada, defining long-term care as housing. Care is such a core component of it as well. But there's this other element that has come into play, and it's protection. Are you feeling more of a rebalancing between living care and protection? Or are we still feeling some of those elements that actually thwart the homeliness, I would say. So is there a balance, and what should that balance be? We have inspections and enforcement, and that seems to be this notion that we need more of that when, as we're looking at the individuals who are now living in our long-term care homes, they're older, the average length of stay is about 18 months. How do we factor in that quality of living, quality of care, while thinking about that safety aspect? I'm hearing from each of you that you feel that your loved one's safe.
I would say, to me, this one's really simple. I want my dad to live well while he's here, but I don't feel the need to prolong my dad's life in a way that's making his life not comfortable. I want him to have quality of life. So to me, I want him to have quality of life as long as he can. And that looks different, obviously, for someone with dementia. But I think it's really important that we think about what happens in long-term care as life and living, not only as care and, I guess, like mitigating risk. I feel like that's really important. From my perspective, I want my dad to live well while he's here, but I don't want him to be restricted in doing the things that he would love to do.
Our ethos, like as a family, was very much the same. It was, for us, the quality of my dad's life was the most important thing. And so I definitely understand that there are, I mean, I work in the system too. I do understand that there are rules and regulations and things that you need to report on and your duty to uphold a certain standard of care, certainly. And I also think that definitely in COVID, we corrected to the real side of enforcement. And I think there's things that we can learn from that, certainly, and take as we move forward. But I do feel like now, as we're entering into that post-COVID era, that the quality of someone's life is also needs to be brought back into the balance. And I totally agree with Krista. It's about someone's life who's living there. Like, you couldn't say it enough. I hope that it comes across, but like, this is someone. And I've said that so many times, like, this was my dad. Like, it matters to me how he lives his life. That's what we're all here to do. We're just walking each other home. Let's do it well.
Krista and I had the privilege of being part of reimagining what the environment would be like to deliver mental health care in. And so much of it was opening up the doors, bringing gardens, having people from within the mental health facility go outside, people coming in to visit. Similarly, we need to allow some freedom and allow our residents in long-term care to come and go, their family members to come and go, people to come in and see. I actually think that one of the greatest ways of ensuring safety and well-being in a long-term care home is having more eyes on. Having more people in the home, having them come and be able to stay in the evening, watching, having more family caregivers, that provides more support to everybody in the home. It creates that sense of community. And we need to do more of that instead of setting up more security systems and enforcement. And I'm hopeful that we will move there.
I think the voice of family caregivers and the voice of residents, for the majority, would say the same.
Yeah, I think so. That's certainly my personal, putting on my caregiver hat, made such a difference. We were 20 years ago, but it's amazing how the experience is very similar. I want to come back to something each of you has actually touched on, and it's that burnout. I know from my own experience, even when my father was in long-term care, I had still reduced my hours at work. I was working 3 days a week, spending 4 days still going to spend time with my mom, visiting my dad every day, supporting him. And like, I'd go for mealtimes and visit him. It was really important for us. And I also know what it was like always worrying if the phone was going to ring and whose telephone number was going to be on the phone. If it was the long-term care home, okay, what's on? What's happening? So there was always still something there. And how did you, Lauren? How are you, Krista, managing your own well-being? Because you were supporting your moms and yourselves. You have your own families. You have your jobs. Laura, you got married in the midst of your father's residence during COVID. What are some insights around managing your own mental health physical well-being, finding your own balance.
Someone said this to me once and it really resonated with me, which is work-life balance or balance in your life looks different every day. So sometimes that means my whole day is about work, and sometimes it means my whole day is about caregiving or being a parent or whatever it is, but it doesn't have to look the same every day. So to me, that's really important. And I think I know my dad's cared for, and I do go and see him, and I miss him when I don't see him, if I don't get there on my regularly scheduled visits. And I really feel that, which I think is a really important thing for me. But I also know he's cared for. So sometimes I have to prioritize other things in my life in order for me to be able to go with him and be present when I'm with him. That's easier now a little bit with long-term care because I know he is cared for and that there's multiple caregivers. That was harder when he was at home and I knew my mom needed a break. So the thing that made me laugh about what you were saying is the phone number on the phone. I now don't panic when I see the phone number come up because they're usually proactively calling me about something. But that took a few months before I wasn't like, oh no, what's wrong? Now it's like, oh, we just want to know, we ordered some new cream for your dad's skin and whatever it is. I'm sure obviously sometimes it's not going to be good, but I don't panic anymore when that phone number shows up.
And that's good. That's encouraging. Laura?
I would say the same. I tried my best, and I think at some times I did it better than others, but I also tried to keep living. And maybe this is a part of a personality of like my own, the way that I'm built. But I think when my dad first got diagnosed, I was also very young. And so when you get this kind of information, I had just turned 20, and I thought, oh my God, my whole world has to stop. It has to stop. There isn't anything that I could do because now every single decision that I have to make has to be about what would be best for my dad. And number one, no one put that on me. I put that on myself. That was never something my dad asked me to do, never something my mom asked me to do, my siblings, no one. That was very much a personal response. I think also out of a place of love because my dad was such a great dad that of course I would want to do that. So I think it took me a while to remember that I still needed to do things. Like I still needed to go ahead and move out of my parents' home after I had moved back in to do caregiving. I still had to go ahead and get married even though our wedding took place outside my dad's window at a long-term care home. Like that was an unusual thing to do, but we still did it.
And it's a good story.
And it's a great story. It's maybe one of my favorite stories.
It's a beautiful story.
It was the best. I mean, a lot of people say the wedding day was the best day, but I actually get to say that it was the best day, and it was the best day. And people just went to the moon and back to make that happen for us and to be able to have somebody sit with my dad at his window and walk him through the ceremony. And we stood right outside so he could see, and he was told what was happening, and he remembered our wedding for a period of time similar to you, Krista, where it's like, there's no money in the world I would pay anything to know that he remembered that. It was so incredible to me. It was incredible to my mom, to everybody in my family. It made such a difference that he got to remember that. But we kept doing things, and my mom would often remind us, like, your dad would want you to keep living. And it was, once he got into long-term care, it was easier for me to do that because it wasn't the hands-on caregiving. And so I was able to go and pursue a master's degree. I hummed and hawed a lot about what I would do about the second semester of my master's degree. And I chose to do the second half of my master's degree abroad. And that was 3 months of not seeing my dad. And that was a really hard choice to make. But it was also something I needed to do for myself. And it was something that my dad would have wanted me to do. And it was something that I was given permission to do because I was allowed to keep living. And it was hard to make that choice. I was in a very unusual position being a younger person and having to weigh these pros and cons of how much time should I go away for. In the beginning, it was like, well, 2 weeks might be a lot. What would happen in 2 weeks? Would he be different when I got back? So as time progressed and as I grew up and as things sort of changed in our world, it was, I think the thing that helped me the most was to remember that I can still live my life, and it is in honor of him and out of respect for him. He wouldn't want me to stop. And of course, you can't live your life up to someone else's standards, but that was something for me that was really helpful, was to keep in the back of my mind, like, it's actually in honor of him that I get to go on and do all these things, and he wouldn't want me to limit myself. And so it allowed me to find a bit more of a balance between caregiving whenever I could and seeing him at his long-term care home whenever I could, and allowing myself the freedom to say, there are things that I need to do for myself too. And that was a huge part for me of him being in long-term care. It allowed me to make that choice again in a way that I hadn't in a while.
My mom used to always say, in order to care for others, you have to care for yourself. And it's so true, but really just echoing, we don't quantify the value of a long-term care home within the context of what it means for family caregivers. Like, imagine if that option weren't there. And we know in Ontario, Canada, our wait list is 48,000 people waiting for long-term care in the province of Ontario alone. And we've got to find a better way, because it's not just impacting the individual waiting for the space, it's their family members. And again, you are both very well-educated, sophisticated navigators of a system that you have both worked in. How do we support others who maybe don't have the same kind of, aren't able to make those choices, and maybe don't have those other kind of supports or the ability to navigate the system? Imagine if you didn't speak English and you're a newcomer and suddenly you're faced with trying to navigate it. And I'm really interested in your sense of, if we could reimagine caregiver system of support. So we always talk about patients and residents. We talk about the frontline staff. But I think really emerging is this role of caregiver. And whether it's a family member or a friend or a neighbor or a colleague, and that person who is the one person who's coming to care and support for somebody, how do we redesign a system that actually supports them emotionally, financially, socially? Because it's very isolating for the family as well as for the individuals who are going into long-term care. But even as they're waiting and don't know what they're waiting for, I think each of you made the point. You worked in the system, but you didn't know long-term care until you got there. And happily, had you known that it was going to be a great transition, it might have calmed things, but you still don't know. So what could and should that system look like? Krista?
Ooh, that's a big question. I would say there's a couple of things I would say. Number one, we have to create awareness about what family caregivers do, because once there's awareness, then we can start to work towards understanding and change. So that's my one goal, is to constantly talk about this. I think we need to look at how society supports caregivers very broadly. So beyond just the long-term care system, we know that caregivers are the glue that keeps the system together. There's stats that say they provide 75% of the care, 80% of the care, 90% of the care. Bottom line is they provide the majority of the care. And many of us are still working. And so we need to think about how employers support caregivers. Like, we know that the rate of new parents in the workplace is going to remain stable. The rate of people caregiving is on the rise. So how do we think about benefits and supports in the workplace in order to do that? Caregivers have skills that workplaces need. Often caregiving falls to the people in the family who are the most capable. Those are the people we want in the workforce. I often say, I don't work less, I just work differently. And we need to start embracing that in the workplace for sure. From a system perspective, the biggest thing from my perspective is how the system works together. I get that long-term care starts at the front door of long-term care, but from a family caregiver perspective, that's not where it starts. So we've got a system that has these silos, and they are incredibly difficult for families to navigate. We have to break down those silos. We need to walk a mile in the shoes of family caregivers and design the system with them as our partner, not design the system to work for the providers. And by the way, if you create that system in a way that works for everybody, everyone's going to be happier. You're going to increase staff satisfaction rates as well as the experience of families and residents and patients, depending on what part of the system you're talking about. I feel very strongly that we need to really think through the system as a system. Because although each part is a different part of the system, technically, as a patient, you're touching all the differences. It's one person going through the system, but it's, you feel like you're to each, every front door is a new front door. It shouldn't be that way.
A system is a group of interdependent parts, and there is no interdependence. And I often liken it to more like the game of Jenga, which is the tower of wooden pieces that are placed precariously on top of one another. And yet we need a jigsaw puzzle where everything fits in to give a coherent vision of what care is going to look like. Laura, you've lived this.
Simply could not agree more that there needs to be more integration across the system. Those silos need to have bridges between them. Like, it's so difficult to navigate. As a registered nurse, I have a parent who is exceptionally smart. She was a very well-educated woman, a master's degree. Like, my mom is the mom. Like, she's got it all under control. She had me at her disposal to help with the healthcare side of things. She had other people at her disposal to help. And yet we still really struggled. Navigating a system when you're somebody who's coming from a position of privilege and having it be so difficult to be in a different type of position or to not have all of the supports that we had and try to navigate through that, I just cannot. I can only imagine how difficult that would be, and have the utmost of respect for folks who are doing this who don't have the services that and the knowledge that we had as a family. I think it's, there needs to be more help for navigating through this. In my dream world, looking at, if we're looking at a totally new system, it's based around the family. Like, my dream is that we talk a lot in nursing about patient-centered care, about family-centered care. That's great when we're looking at our one-to-one relationships, how a medical team provides for a patient and the family. Why doesn't that extend to the system? We need to have a system that is able to support the whole family unit as they go through each different stage of needing primary care, emergency care, a stay in the hospital, a transition into long-term care. If we could put the person at the center of that, the navigation of it would be a lot easier. And to reorient the system around the people who use it, around the patients, the residents, and their families would make a huge difference in helping to build bridges across different silos, because it's very difficult to navigate. I could go on forever.
It always amazes me that once you go into long-term care, you lose, if you don't stay with your primary care provider, you don't stay with your community supports, and suddenly it's all the long-term care home is going to start over. Yet those are the individuals, those professionals are the ones who cared for you in your local community throughout your life. And they're the one who know you and your family and your history. And yet you now move into a different system with a different medical record and a different way of tracking and a different pharmacy who's managing you and supporting you. And it really doesn't make sense. I've got two questions left. One question is something I want to come back to, Krista, you alluded to, and we had chatted about before we were recording, and that's, what are the skills and competencies of a caregiver? So many people are caregiving and they don't realize just what skills they have.
Yeah, so I do a lot of work in this space, and there's research being done around it, and it's a growing body of evidence. We know that caregivers are project managers, financial managers. They know how to navigate complex systems. They're constantly learning new information. They're advocating for change or for something that they need in a place where they don't have formal influence. They're dealing with relationships, difficult relationships. They're learning patience. There's so many elements of what we do all the time as caregivers that we need in the workplace, but also that just skills that we're gaining over time that need to be recognized. And I think there's tons of opportunities for improvement in recognizing and acknowledging that, for sure.
The caregiver identity, just identifying as a caregiver is a challenge, because so many people don't. They don't understand that's what they're actually doing, and they are. In turn, they don't fully appreciate what those skills and competencies are that they've developed in it and or honed during that caregiver journey. And it's so important to validate what they bring to the role. Long-term care is always a very serious discussion, and we do try to bring some joy and life into things. So each of you have already spoken about a gift that you received with your fathers in long-term care. So Laura, your father attending and remembering your wedding, Krista, your father retaining the gift of speech and language and sentences. Are there other gifts or moments of joy that come to mind as you think about your experience as a caregiver? And as you reflect back on your evolution in this role, share something magical.
Okay, I would say when I think about my dad, I really do think I'm the female version of him. So I feel like I could really relate to him when he was before his disease. And I always say that as hard as it is, I have had a different kind of time with my dad in these last 10 years that is gentler, it's slower. I've learned to love him in a different way and actually just gain that whole appreciation for him, despite the fact that he's not what you would think of as a typical father. And so that's been really beautiful. And then I would say one other really important thing is I was a mom, and really my dad was diagnosed when my daughter was born, essentially. So I've been a working caregiver, sandwich generation working caregiver. But to see how my daughter interacts with him and how she sees me interact with him is really profound, because she understands what that means. And there's a tenderness that she has when she's with him, which is pretty impressive as a teenager. You don't see that side, but when she's with him, I see it. And to me, that's been incredibly beautiful.
Laura.
I think one of the things that along this journey has been really powerful and really impactful for me, I think, is to meet other people who have had a similar experience. I mean, I was introduced to Krista, and on our very first phone call, she was like, oh, wow. Okay, so we have had the same life. And I was like, I have gone for 10 years having no one understand that. And so I think it's meeting other people who have a shared experience, and then someone who is able to say to me, like, wow, I can't believe you were a young caregiver. I can't believe you were a double duty caregiver. And to your previous point, Donna, I didn't realize that I was a caregiver. I was like, well, no, I'm just a kid. And I had a dad who needed something. And isn't that what you just do for your family? Like, I wasn't able to even see myself in that light. So to have met people who will look at me and say, wow, you did a really good job and you gained so many skills and you've learned so much from this, there's a lot of validation in that. So I think even in this experience after my dad has passed, being able to talk about him, remembering these different types of things, and then having people validate my experience and giving me a lot of kind words and a lot of validation in an experience that I had felt was very isolating, despite the fact that I had great family support and great friendship support. I think that's been something that's been really incredible for me. And I think it's interesting. I am the mirror of my dad. I look like my mom and I act like my dad. So on our family, my mom has always said this. She goes, you're me on the outside, but you're your dad on the inside. And so it was really funny. I think even in like at times that have gone by that I think back on, the gifts that were given to us were a lot of really little moments. Like a PSW who took my, I could cry thinking about it right now, but she took my hand. She goes, my God, you know how happy he is when you get to come in and see him? Like, to have somebody recognize that, she's like, you make such a difference in his day and you're so good at being with your dad. Like, the validation in that even as a family member is really incredible. So I think it's a lot of small moments that have built up to having really beautiful memories, despite the fact that there were a lot of hard times too. Like, caregiving is a really hard job. Transitioning into long-term care can be really difficult. There were days when my dad was in long-term care that I found very difficult. So it's not an easy road, but I think when you have small moments of connection with people and validation, that's what for me has been the real like joy bringer. And it's been really special for me.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing your stories. It's so great to hear your personal perspectives. I know these are not easy stories to tell. I know each of you've spoken about shedding tears, and exposes your vulnerability. So thank you for sharing your compassion, your vulnerability, your perspective. I think we all need to do a better job in telling the story of long-term care within the context of a system that it is about living. Celebrating the compassion and the connection of the frontline staff and their commitment to families, those relationships and how key they are. I dare to dream of another world. And as our listeners know, I talk often about those parallels between mental illness and the mental health sector and seniors and long-term care. If we had known 25 years ago, 20 years ago, Krista, that everybody would be talking about their mental health today, we celebrate incrementalism. We'll take each day as we can, and we just won't accept the status quo. And you are agents of change. And it's such a delight to have you on Coming of Age to share your message, feed the movement, create more momentum, and discover the art of the possible. And together we can. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, both of you. I do need to run because the third period has started. So
thank you for listening to Coming of Age. If you like this episode, please follow and share. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Plan A. Plan A Senior Care Staffing and Recruitment is Canada's leading staffing, recruitment, and retention partner dedicated to the senior care sector. They focus on connecting long-term care and retirement homes with skilled and compassionate healthcare professionals. With the addition of Plan A Allied, they've expanded their reach to offer more than 20 healthcare and support service designations, providing a flexible and dependable solution to meet the unique and evolving needs of their senior care partners. The strength of Plan A lies in the dedication of the professionals behind it. Plan A offers meaningful work in the senior care sector, along with flexible scheduling that supports a healthy work-life harmony, so individuals can make an impact while maintaining balance. Because every resident deserves consistent, compassionate care, Plan A delivers reliable staffing solutions and meaningful work for healthcare professionals across the senior care sector.